Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei describes poisoning of school children in the country as an unforgivable crime, calling on authorities to investigate the issue. Authorities in Bangladesh launched an investigation into a massive fire at a Rohingya refugee camp that left around 12,000 of the Muslims without shelter. And a bomb blast targeting a truck carrying paramilitary forces in Pakistan's southwestern city of Quetta leaves at least 9 people dead and over a dozen others injured.
Well, welcome to the studios from the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called on officials to seriously pursue the issue of poisoning of students after cases were reported in a number of cities. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the poisonings are a major and unforgivable crime. The leader says the perpetrators must be handed the maximum punishment if the incidents are proven to be poisonings. Cases of such attacks have been reported in dozens of schools for girls over the past months. The incidents have reportedly left an unspecified number of students hospitalized. President Ebrahim Raisi has already ordered the Ministers of Intelligence and the Interior to follow up on the cases. Iran has pledged to keep the flow of information on its nuclear program to the International Atomic Energy Agency, but the country says that would be within the framework of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the Safeguards Agreement. The pledge was made by the Director of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran in an exclusive interview with Press TV. Mohammad Islami said Tehran is committed to cooperation with the agency. Islami also said that Iran won't give in to Washington's maximum pressure campaign and attempts to pressure the country through the UN nuclear watchdog. He also talked about the 2015 nuclear deal. Islami said that Iran rolled back its commitments because of the delay tactics by other parties to impede a consensus. His comments come a day after a visit by the IAEA chief to Iran. It led to an agreement under which Iran voluntarily allowed the agency to conduct more verification and monitoring activities in the country.
The stalemate between Tehran and the three remaining signatories to the Iran deal over reviving the 2015 landmark agreement has once again brought the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, to the Iranian capital. Rafael Grossi held talks with a number of Iranian officials, including President Ebrahim Raisi, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, and head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami. During a joint press conference with Iran nuclear chief, Grossi said his meetings in Iran took place in an atmosphere of cooperation.
The atmosphere is an atmosphere of work, of honesty and cooperation, and I think this is it is the most important thing. Our dialogue will continue today.
The IAEA chief also expressed hope that his meetings with Iranian officials would produce good results.
We are working hard. What I can tell you is that our teams, we have been working. Now we are taking recess to come and talk to you. But we are working hard in order to have good solutions today. Thank you.
He also hailed his meetings with Iranian authorities as constructive.
By having a constructive discussion like we are having now and having good agreements like I am sure we are going to have, we are going to be paving the way for important agreements. And this is my hope.
Iran Atomic Chief also addressed the reporters. Islami said the Islamic Republic has no reservation about advancing its nuclear program, adding that the country will not give up on its national interests. Regarding claims about uranium enrichment, Islami said the IAEA's report has confirmed Iran has not enriched uranium beyond its declared 60%. He added the issue has now been resolved between the two sides. Islami underlined that the meetings show Tehran and the IAEA maintain professional relationship.
The visit by the head of the IAEA comes as the UN agency is accused of bias when it comes to Iran's nuclear program. Tehran has been critical of the agency's political approach and says the UN watchdog is under the influence of Israel, which is not even a party to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
The recent visit by the IAEA chief to Iran comes as many throughout the world have raised doubts over the impartiality of the UN agency. This comes to the spotlight, especially when the UN nuclear watchdog has always failed to address questions about the agency's inspection of Israeli nuclear sites. During his press conference, Grossi argued that Israel is not a party to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT, and therefore the agency cannot technically inspect Israeli sites. Given that, one would argue that the IAEA, along with the international community, have failed to pressure the Israeli regime to become a member of the agreement. After all, the regime in Tel Aviv possesses more than 400 nuclear warheads, which can by default be an enormous threat to the entire world. In the meantime, Iran has been critical of the UN agency for acting politically in cases related to the technical issues of the country's nuclear program. Tehran says the agency acts under the influence of certain countries, but the IAEA claims otherwise.
The IAEA has not been and will never be a political tool of anybody. I, as Director General, I am independent. I am under no country's instructions.
Iran's concern can be clearly felt in President Ebrahim Raisi's remarks when he met with Rafael Grossi on Saturday. President Raisi said Tehran will continue to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency if the IAEA preserves its independence and defend the rights of the Iranian people. Raisi said Tehran expects the agency's activities not to be under the influence of certain world powers who pursue their personal interests. The president called on the IAEA to express realities about Iran's nuclear program without any partiality and based on professional behavior. This is significantly debatable when one argues that the International Atomic Energy Agency has even failed to condemn terrorist attacks on Iranian nuclear sites as well as those targeting Iranian scientists. This is while the pressure is always coming from entities like Israel that are not even a party to the NPT. The pressure is also coming from countries like the United States that they themselves are in possession of hundreds or maybe thousands of nuclear warheads and a threat to humanity by nature.
A massive fire rips through a Rohingya refugee camp in Bangladesh, robbing around 12,000 people of their shelter. The flames swept through the Kutu Palong camp and gutted some 2,000 huts before it was brought under control. 90 facilities, including hospitals and schools, were burnt down as a result. Bangladeshi authorities are yet to release the number of casualties. They say that an investigation is underway to determine the cause of the fire. An estimated 1 million Rohingya Muslims live in the world's largest refugee camp in Bangladesh. They escaped to Bangladesh in 2017 after genocide by the military in their homeland, Myanmar. At least 9 police officers are killed and 16 others wounded in a bombing attack in the southwest Pakistan. The bombing targeted a truck carrying paramilitary forces in Quetta, Balochistan province. The suspected bomber rammed his explosive-laden motorbike into the vehicle. The death toll is expected to rise, as the injured officers are reported to be in critical condition. Shortly after the explosion, the Taliban in Pakistan claimed responsibility for the attack. The group has been blamed for a string of bombings and other terrorist attacks in Pakistan recently. Officials say that such attacks have surged since August 2021 when the Taliban took power in Afghanistan. The South Korean government has agreed to compensate the victims of forced labor under the former Japanese Empire. That's an attempt to remove the issue of compensations as a major hurdle to the normalization of ties with Tokyo.
As part of the support for forced labor victims and their family members, the Foundation for Victims of Forced Mobilization by Imperial Japan will pay compensation and delayed interest to the plaintiffs of 3 Supreme Court decisions in 2018.
Foreign Minister described the move as a window of opportunity and a last chance to overcome hostility with Japan. He also urged Tokyo to offer a comprehensive apology. South Korea has time and again pressed Japan to compensate the survivors and families of its occupation between 1910 and 1945. Around 800,000 South Koreans were conscripted into forced labor by Japan during that period. Meanwhile, the Japanese foreign minister has welcomed South Korea's decision. The minister reiterated, however, that Tokyo stands by a 1998 declaration on the issue.
On this occasion, the Japanese government confirms that it continues to hold the same understanding of history as previous cabinets, including on the 1998 Japan-South Korea Joint Declaration.
Hayashi also said the new plan will help restore healthy ties. South Korea's Supreme Court had earlier ordered Japanese companies to pay the compensation for forced labor. The U-turn on the ruling has sparked backlash from victims and South Korea's main opposition party. They've accused the government of capitulating to Japan. Azerbaijani troops and ethnic Armenians have exchanged gunfire in the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh, killing at least five people. Azerbaijan's defense ministry says two servicemen were killed in an exchange of fire after troops stopped a convoy suspected of carrying weapons. Armenia's foreign ministry has announced the death of three officials from the Karabakh interior ministry. Yerevan has dismissed Azerbaijan's allegations that the convoy was carrying arms. Nagorno-Karabakh was the focal point of two wars in recent years that ended with Russia's mediation. The disputed region has pitted Azerbaijan against Armenia for more than three decades. Leaders of both countries have met several times as part of efforts to resolve the conflict, but periodic violence has hindered peace efforts. Hundreds of Austrians have taken to the streets of Vienna to protest against weapons delivery to Ukraine and the American business of wars. The protesters called for Austria's neutrality, stressing that delivery weapons can never bring peace. They also slammed the European Union's policy toward the war in Ukraine. They added that Austria's membership in the bloc has forced the country to support what the Union decides. Several European countries have seen rallies against Western arms flow to Ukraine since the start of the war last year. The U.S. and its Western allies have provided billions of dollars in weapons to Ukraine so far. Johnny Miller has been covering the war in Ukraine from Donetsk for months. He is in Tehran now, and we talked to him face-to-face about his experience of the war. He says the Western media are ignoring reports of the Ukrainian military shelling people in the east, as that is in conflict with the narrative that they are promoting.
There's many fantastic journalists in the Western mainstream, many honest reporters, fantastic journalists. And anybody who went to Donetsk or spent the 5 months in Donetsk like I have, they wouldn't be able to report any or much different than I've been reporting. I mean, and that's what you see in the CNN piece in 2014. Basically, it's using exactly the same words that I've used about this terror bombing of the people of Donetsk. But it's clear also that the mainstream has not wanted to cover this story. Why? Because it's embarrassing to the narrative. NATO countries are trying to say that the only way to end this war is to send more weapons. Well, if some of these weapons are being purposefully used to kill, as they say, their own civilians, and the vast majority of people in Donetsk no longer want to be part of Ukraine, well, that's difficult, isn't it? Then that suggests there is another way out of the conflict. So whether Russia's allowing them in or whether they're just not going at all, it's clear that's not being covered on purpose, and I think it's so important for it to be covered.
France is bracing for nationwide strikes and demonstrations in a decisive showdown with President Emmanuel Macron's pension reform plans. All major unions representing workers from various sectors, including railways and energy, have called for walkouts. More than 260 demos are also expected on Tuesday. Police are expecting the participation of up to nearly 1.5 million people. A similar nationwide protest was held in late January that was the largest since former President Nicolas Sarkozy introduced the last round of pension reforms in 2010. Macron's administration wants to raise the retirement age to 64, arguing that the change is necessary due to the country's deficits forecast for the next 25 years. Opponents say the plan would penalize low-skilled workers who start their careers early while reducing their right to leisure and a long retirement at the end. The Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has hailed his country's resilience in the face of what he called the U.S. colonial empire.
The United States Empire thought they could impose their colonial empire in our country, but we have clearly said no to the colonial model, yes to a free country.
Maduro made the comments in a ceremony to mark the 10th anniversary of the death of former Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Several Latin American leaders, including the presidents of Cuba, Nicaragua, and Bolivia, attended the ceremony. Also, thousands of people visited the burial place of Chavez in Caracas to commemorate the former president's death. Chavez served as president for 14 years before his death in 2013. His tenure marked constitutional changes and confrontations with the U.S. In the U.S., over 40 million poor people have just seen a major reduction in their federal assistance in buying food. Experts on food insecurity are warning that the country is about to fall off what they are calling a hunger cliff. Rami Mazari has more on this story from Chicago.
Even though inflation remains at a 40-year high, United States President Joe Biden has terminated a program which provided extra food money for over 40 million of the poorest Americans. The elderly, the disabled, students, poor children and the working poor are now forced to find an average of nearly $100 more every month to spend on food. With sanctions on Russia still massively backfiring across the West, grocery prices here have soared more than 11% over the last year.
The families aren't purchasing food at the same price that they were pre-pandemic. So if not, you know, apart from having families come in more often, we may start seeing families that have to cut back on their housing budget. So what they typically spent on rent, utilities, they may have to start dipping into that to pay for groceries.
Experts on food insecurity contend that food aid to the poor has been insufficient, and that was long before the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program started seeing cuts. The expansion of so-called food stamps was both popular and successful, leading to an immediate 10% reduction in the overall poverty rate and a 14% drop in child poverty.
Versus 2021, when a lot of the pandemic relief was in force, our numbers were actually down significantly. So we've seen our numbers grow from 2021 to 2022 about 40%. Give or take. We can only imagine what this next round will bring.
Without government involvement, citizens can only turn to charities for help. In states which have prematurely stopped the expanded food aid, food banks are already reporting a 40% increase in the number of visitors. Last year, the ruling Democrats voted to end the pandemic's expansion of Medicaid, the federal program which provides a bare minimum of health care for the nation's poor. At the end of this month, at least 15 million people will also lose their health care coverage. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sadorbat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line. of French interference in Africa had ended. These were the words of the French President Emmanuel Macron before departing for his African tour, which begged the question, didn't his African tour mean that it had not ended? Macron's destinations, Gabon, Angola, Congo, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. His goal? To restore its influence after a series of military and political setbacks. Africanization, as opposed to Francafrique, which Macron said is over. But what is Francafrique? Francafrique refers to the time after the wave of decolonization in 1960, when France propped up dictators in its former colonies in exchange for access to resources and military bases. Some of France's colonies in West Africa included Senegal, Mali, Burkina Faso, Benin, Guinea, the Ivory Coast, and Niger. Macron and his predecessors, notably François Hollande, have said that the policy is dead and that France had no intention of meddling in sovereign affairs. But not all Africans are buying it. Like this Congolese resident who said that France was turning its attention to Central Africa because of a breakdown in relations with former West African colonies. To say that France has a crisis or breakdown in relations on its hand is an understatement. On the one hand, Macron has repeatedly sought to shake off the label of former colonial power, motivated by commercial gain. And when it comes to France's military involvement, the security crisis in West Africa's Sahel region had fueled anti-French protests, bringing juntas to power in Burkina Faso and Mali, which did not want long-standing military ties with France. France was forced to withdraw troops from former colonies, Burkina Faso, the Central African Republic, and from Mali. This was not a matter of choice, and it is quite evident since France still desires to have some kind of military footprint in these countries.
Au fond, la logique, c'est que notre modèle ne doit plus être celui de bases militaires telles qu'elles existent aujourd'hui.
The French President Emmanuel Macron must have deemed Africa to be so important that he decided on this tour. He urged French companies to bid for contracts in Africa and to be more respectful of African nations. But the French president may have an ulterior motive behind his visit. Russia. France was forced to withdraw its forces from Mali last year after the junta opted to work with Russian forces. And to add salt to injury, the Central African Republic had also chosen to work with Russian forces. This was a big worry for France, since there was now a domino effect which excluded France, coming at a time when Western countries are trying to lobby the Global South against Russia over its special military operation in Ukraine. African countries' decision to work with Russia may be a reflection of a bigger wave of anti-Western sentiments, which is not restricted to France only. The U.S. has also fallen behind in Africa, and like France, not only blasts Russia for its presence in Africa, but has also slammed China for its investments in the continent. The former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton couldn't make it any clearer when he said predatory practices by China and Russia stunt economic growth in Africa and threaten nations' economic independence. It appears that African nations are no longer buying that view and have made the shift to countries that are providing them with what they want, security cooperation and trade rewards, as is the case with Russia and China, in line with the new world order that is taking shape. The Israeli regime is stepping up its violent and racist policies against Palestinians. On Thursday, a young Palestinian man succumbed to his injuries that he recently sustained during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jericho, also known as Ariha. 22-year-old Mahmoud Jamal Hamdan was critically wounded during an Israeli attack on a refugee camp. On Wednesday, Israeli troops stormed the Aqaba Jab refugee camp following a shooting attack on a highway outside of Jericho that left one Israeli soldier dead. During the raid, the regime's forces sealed off the camp and prevented ambulances and journalists from entering it. They also fatally wounded Hamdan, whom they accused of being involved in the attack. Regime atrocities come against the backdrop of increasing settler violence against Palestinians. On Sunday night, hundreds of armed Israeli settlers, flanked by soldiers, attacked Palestinian villages near the West Bank town of Huwara and set fire to homes, storefronts, and cars.
I was here yesterday when the incident occurred. I didn't know how to escape, as they closed immediately all roads and exits. So I was obliged to stay here. I locked the door, and after that the settlers came to burn things. They set fire to all the wood I had, the car, and they burnt the area.
At least one Palestinian was killed and nearly 400 were wounded in the hours-long rampage, which was denounced by Israeli rights group Peace Now and B'Tselem as a settler pogrom supported by the occupying regime. Palestinian officials have called on the U.S. Security Council to ensure protection for Palestinians who have increasingly come under deadly attacks by Israeli forces and settlers.
What we have seen here in this house is evidence of how big the crime carried out by the settlers and covered by army and protected by the army is. It is clear that this move is supported by a political decision from the Israeli cabinet. Therefore, three sides are partners in this crime. The cabinet, which takes the political decision, the army, which is protecting the settlers, and the settlers who are implementing. This is what we have seen here.
The Arab League has also said that it fully holds the far-right Israeli administration, led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, responsible for the systematic crimes committed by extremist settlers. After they went on a violent rampage in the West Bank, Israeli forces have killed nearly 70 Palestinians since the beginning of this year. On Tuesday, the Israeli Knesset approved a bill authorizing the execution of Palestinian detainees, conduct anti-occupation operations. Hamas resistance movement has strongly condemned the bill, noting that the move reflects the regime's, quote, fascist tendencies. Hamas has stressed that such policies and laws will not deter the Palestinian people from continuing their legitimate resistance against the Israeli occupation. Furthermore, on Wednesday, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, who is an ultra-nationalist in Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extremist coalition, said that the Palestinian village of Huwara should be wiped out.
All over Israel, here in Tel Aviv and elsewhere, we are protesting against the horrific pogrom committed by the extremist settlers in the West Bank yesterday. They came because they have the support of the government. They have the support of high-ranking Kahanist ministers serving in the government, and they are deepening the occupation, deepening the bloodshed.
So we are here tonight to demonstrate after the settlers in Hawara attacked and burned the village and the people who live in Hawara, the Palestinian people. And we are here to demonstrate to stop the occupation.
Even the U.S. administration, which is Tel Aviv's staunch ally, has called the remarks repugnant. Attacks against Palestinians have escalated since late December 2022, when Benjamin Netanyahu returned to power as prime minister of the occupying regime's most far-right cabinet ever. Netanyahu is now under mounting pressure. Streets across the occupied territories have witnessed mass protests since Netanyahu's controversial move to reform the judiciary. Opponents argued that the legal changes threaten the independence of judges and weaken oversight of the ruling cabinet and parliament. They say the plan will undermine the rights of minorities and would open the door to more corruption. But Netanyahu, who is on trial for corruption, says the changes will boost business. There are now threats that his coalition cabinet will break up due to internal differences and mass protests.
A year has passed since the ongoing war in Ukraine broke out. Prospects for an end to the war look bleak. Instead of supporting dialogue and a peaceful resolution, the West, particularly the US, have fanned the flames of war by sending billions of dollars in arms to Ukraine. This trend has only further escalated the conflict. Last week, Beijing called for a comprehensive ceasefire as it released a peace plan to end the war in Ukraine. The document, which covers 12 aspects, adheres to the principle of respecting the sovereignty of both countries. It calls for resuming peace talks and promotes the post-conflict reconstruction in the long run. Beijing also demanded an end to unilateral sanctions on Russia and criticized NATO expansion, saying the US and NATO are fanning the flames and adding fuel to the fire, and they are the culprit and pusher of the crisis. China also made clear its opposition to not only the use of nuclear weapons, but the threat of deploying them, saying nuclear weapons must not be used and nuclear wars must not be fought. In addition, China also called for efforts to set up humanitarian corridors for the evacuation of civilians from conflict zones, to protect civilians and prisoners of war, and to facilitate grain exports. China has sought to position itself as a neutral party in the conflict and play the role of a mediator. Meanwhile, Russia said it has paid a lot of attention to the plan by China, but the conditions for a peaceful resolution of the conflict were not in place. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said, "For now, we don't see any of the conditions that are needed to bring this whole story towards peace." Moscow had said that any settlement of the conflict needed to recognize Russia's control over four Ukrainian regions it annexed last year. It also wants Ukraine to renounce its bid to join NATO. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said his country needed to work with China, arguing it seems that there is a respect for Ukraine's territorial integrity and security issues in the Chinese perspective. However, Kyiv said that it will not agree to any peace without the return of all its territory. The publication of the proposal follows accusations from the West that China is considering arming Russia, a claim Beijing has dismissed as false information. Ukraine's head of military intelligence has brushed aside claims that China is considering sending arms to Russia. Kirill Budanov told US media that he saw no signs that such things are even being discussed. That's after senior US officials said that they were confident China was considering providing lethal equipment to Moscow. Earlier this month, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken aired Washington's concerns about potential arms shipments in a tense meeting with his Chinese counterpart. Also, the director of the CIA, William Burns, said in an interview on Sunday that he believed Beijing was still weighing the possibility. Asked specifically about the U.S. assessment, Budanov said, "I am the head of intelligence and I rely, with all due respect, not on the opinions of individual people, but only on facts. I do not see such facts." China says it has kept contact with all sides in the crisis, including Kyiv, and its position was clear. The core is to call for peace and promote dialogue and promote a political solution to the crisis. China has warned that the war in Ukraine is getting out of control. Beijing has urged certain countries to stop adding fuel to the fire, saying it's deeply concerned about the situation. Beijing rejected the US and NATO claims as false and said it is the US that is endlessly sending arms to Ukraine, not China. The US and NATO have been warning China against sending weapons to Russia, while they have been providing Ukraine with billions of dollars in arms and military aid since the beginning of the war a year ago.
The US desire to dominate the world by poking its nose into other countries' affairs, especially when things are not in its favor, is not hidden anymore. In the latest example, Russia has come out accusing Washington of attempting to disrupt its relations with nations on the African continent. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov said the United States and its allies are conducting an unprecedented campaign for Russia's political and economic isolation, including the disruption of the second Russia-Africa summit in St. Petersburg scheduled for July. Bogdanov said Western countries embarked on their collective campaign to isolate Russia in the international arena ever since the beginning of this special military operation in Ukraine. He noted that the West, in order to achieve its anti-Russia agenda, has significantly piled up pressure on African countries through threats of imposing sanctions, termination of financial and humanitarian aid. Bogdanov's assessment came more than a month after Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited South Africa as part of his African tour. During Lavrov's visit to Pretoria, which was the second since last year, the two sides pledged to boost bilateral ties. and a joint presser, top South African diplomat Naledi Pandor even lauded the growing economic partnership between the two countries, along with political, economic, social, defense, and security cooperation. Lavrov's successful visit to the continent and planned Russia-Africa summit and economic forum in July are testimonies that West, the U.S. in particular, have failed in their plots to isolate Russia internationally. Visit by the Russian diplomat to South Africa refurbished the common pursuit of the two countries for upholding world peace and security and promoting global development and prosperity. With South Africa hosting the Summit of Five Emerging Economies, commonly known as BRICS, this year, the ruling African National Congress has suggested that Pretoria could use the chairmanship to push for the admission of new members to expand the bloc and challenge the global arrogance. In the words of Pandor herself, the current global geopolitical tensions clearly signal the need to create institutional mechanisms that will have the stature from the global trust to promote and support global peace and security. BRICS should play a proactive role in emerging processes and ensure it is part of a redesigned global order. Recent joint naval drills involving South Africa, Russia, and China, despite U.S. criticism, show these countries' resolve to stand against the global dominance of some powers. Pandor argued that hosting such maneuvers with what she called friends were part of the natural course of relations. Nevertheless, the popular resentment against the West, the U.S., the U.K., and France in particular, are on the rise due to their historic oppression on the continent. Anti-West sentiment could be clearly seen in nationwide protests in Burkina Faso, with demonstrators condemning former colonizer France while waving Russian flags. Growing dissatisfaction with France is largely visible in other former colonies across Africa, including Mali. At this moment, the unity is an anti-colonial power structure seem to be of high urgency for African nations. A change from unipolar to multipolar arrangement is another need, especially for East African countries that are embroiled in power politics. These could uplift not only the continental stature, but a unified power to reckon with. However, this major paradigm shift can be duly achievable if countries across the African continent come together and stand firm against the West's imperialism.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3rd, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. The ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Office and Police Training. And the great movement to defend the Holy Shrine, both in social services and in scientific developments, as you can see, advancements in any scientific field are in fact made by the youth. They are the ones who drive this movement. Furthermore, we have seen in religious ceremonies, such as the Arba'in Walk, how millions of young Iranians traveled the path from Najaf to Karbala, and how millions more walked inside the country itself. Those who could not attend the Arba'in Walk in that spiritual environment walked in different cities inside Iran instead. In the fields of production and innovation, as you can see on television, our youth are bringing something new to the country's manufacturing and industrial sectors. Every day, everywhere you look, you see the exceptional presence of young people there. Whether it is in dealing with an epidemic, in a religious aid movement, cultural work, or in relief projects during natural disasters such as floods, earthquakes, and the like. This young person is not going to despair. This young person is not going to detach himself or herself from his or her values. This young person is an inexhaustible force on the field. And of course, the young pious revolutionary youth have been leaders in all these fields. This is the current situation of our young people.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Well, with this point of view, if we look at your presence here, those who have gathered in the Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Office and Police Training, and also those who are hearing this speech in other universities, your presence and entry into the armed forces is a great asset. Your presence is a great asset. Of course, when it is alongside the experience of our veterans and the knowledge of the commanders. Strengthening the armed forces means strengthening the country. The armed forces are one of the strong pillars that strengthen the country. Of course, strengthening the country does not just depend on the armed forces. There are also other strong pillars. Scientific advancements are a source of the country's progress. The general faith of the people and the penetration of faith into people's hearts is a source of national strength.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
The Holy Quran. This is a heavenly book, which is the apparent and written form of the aggregate of names, attributes, signs, and expressions, and whose unseen stations our hand falls short of reaching, except the sacred being embodying one who is the being addressed, none knows its secret. Through the blessings of the sacred essence and by his teaching, the pure noble saints have comprehended the Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear audience, you're listening to this episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. Well, in this program, what we do is to read some of the valuable speeches of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi and explain about the interpretations. We hope that in that way, we as lovers of this great character would come to a deeper understanding of Imam Khomeini's thoughts and ideologies. One of the sentences of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh about the religion of Islam is, Islam has come to train mankind. The issue in the program of Islam is man and his training. Well, in this part of his speech, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh is referring to the purpose of Islam, and that purpose is training. In fact, the purpose of Islam is to make human beings aware of their duties and responsibilities in front of God. The method used in most of our religious texts and instructions is inductive, in the way that people are supposed to derive the general principles of life by using logic, reason, and facts. Such type of training encompasses so many topics that following them leads to a real and perfect manifestation of Muslim life. The sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh is also supported by this verse from the Holy Book of Quran. أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ كَمَا أَرْسَلْنَا فِيكُمْ رَسُولًا مِنْكُمْ يَتْلُو عَلَيْكُمْ آيَاتُنَا وَيُزَكِّيكُمْ وَيُعَلِّمُكُمُ الْكِتَابَ وَالْحِكْمَةَ وَيُعَلِّمُكُمْ مَا لَمْ تَكُونُوا تَعْلَمُونَ. Even as we sent you an apostle from among yourselves, who recites to you our signs and purifies you and teaches you the book and wisdom and teaches you what you don't know. The 151st verse of Surah Al-Baqarah.
Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi salli ala
You can see that, as mentioned in this verse, the Prophet is sent to teach human beings and make them ponder about their existence, and it is in that way that a man starts to see himself as a small creature in front of Allah's majesty and decides to change his manners and conducts to please Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That is why Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh sees training as one of the main purposes of Islam, and he trained lots of faithful soldiers of Islam with his ideology and was a great leader for them through the great Islamic revolution. If you listen to what merchants of the obligatory war said about the purpose of their participation in the war, you can see that most of them confessed that they are following and highly influenced by Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh and his command for them to participate in the war. And this shows how proficient he was in training those soldiers of Islam.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
every night and every day,
every night and every day, never forget to say La ilaha
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's episode, we will be discussing two major issues, the Iran-India trade ties and the freedom of two brothers from Guantanamo after 20 years. So, stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss Iran's trade with India crosses $2 billion, registering 59.57% rise compared to the previous year. And we shall also take a look at two Pakistani brothers reach home after spending 20 years at Guantanamo without charges.
Iran's trade with India has crossed the $2 billion mark. The Islamic Republic's total exports to India hit more than $600 million during the year 2022, registering a 63.09% rise compared to the corresponding period of the previous year. According to estimates, the potential capacity of Iran's exports to India is equivalent to $21 billion. Experts believe that facilitating trade between the two countries will lead to the development of the economics of both of the countries.
According to the recent figures released by the Indian Ministry of Commerce and Industries, the net worth of Iran's exports to India stood at $653 million in 2022. The figure was $409 million in the year 2021, thus showing a definite increase since last year. India, being a major buyer of Iranian crude oil, petroleum products imported by India from Iran estimated a total worth of around $175 million. The other exported products included dye intermediates worth $152 million, fresh fruit $148 million, and residual chemicals including allied products worth $40 million. Iran and India bilateral trade during the fiscal year 2022 rose to $2.5 billion from $1.693 billion in 2021, showing a 48% rise. On the other hand, India's exports to Iran have also shown a considerable increase. During January-December 2022, India's exports to Iran rose 44% to stand at $1.847 billion, while the figure was $1.284 billion in 2021. Rice has been Iran's major import from India during the year 2022. India has shipped $1.098 billion worth of basmati rice to Iran. The other exports from the South Asian country include tea worth $79 million, sugar worth $66 million, other types of rice worth $61 million, and organic chemicals worth $44 million.
India has a pivotal role to play in Iran's economic ambitions, paving a way for it to increase its power beyond its immediate neighbors and improve its financial dynamics. For New Delhi, Tehran is a cheap and important source of oil and also provides road to reach the vast Central Asian markets. According to experts, the Islamic Republic of Iran holds strategic importance for the country of India. However, the current ties are primarily governed by economic interests.
New Delhi and Tehran have converging interests in trade and connectivity. India and Iran have also been trying to diversify their channels of payment to increase bilateral trade. According to the Iranian Foreign Ministry, the two sides are preparing a roadmap for strategic cooperation between Iran and India that can help regulate long-term relations and protect from the impact of destructive factors. As regards in India's imports from Iran, mineral fuels and oils dominate the import basket, accounting for as much as 90% of India's total imports from Iran. However, according to experts, both Iran and India are interested in developing economic and trade relations beyond energy and petrochemical products. Complementarity between New Delhi and Tehran's economies provides a base for exploring non-oil areas, including goods and services, investment, tourism, education, handicrafts, etc. This, according to international affairs analysts, will pave the way for strengthening the economic relations between the two countries furthermore. The countries have been also trying to diversify the channels of payments to expand the already existing mechanism to cover more goods and services, including all of the non-petroleum products.
Now, to have more insights on this, we are joined by Mr. Paul Cochran, an independent financial journalist from South Africa. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, Iran's annual exports to India have risen considerably, reaching up to 60%. So how do you see the strengthening economic ties between the two countries in the context of the present world situation?
Over the past year between India and Iran, but it's still just 10%. Of what it was in 2019, when it was about $17 billion. And that stopped because of U.S. pressure after Trump, President Trump, pulled out of the nuclear deal. I mean, at that time, India was supplying around, was supplying around 10% of India's oil needs. And that trade could easily bounce back to those sort of figures. But that's very much dependent on if the conditions become more favorable, such as India being allowed by the U.S. to import more Iranian oil. And from what we're seeing, the U.S. isn't going to budge on this at all. But there's a lot of things happening, obviously, you know, globally, geopolitically, that could change things. And it makes utter sense, I mean, for India and Iran to strengthen economic ties, particularly given the geographic proximity. I mean, particularly since the COVID pandemic, more and more countries are diversifying their sourcing of goods and products, as well as nearshoring. So nearshoring is buying goods and getting goods from closer to home to not have these problems like happened during the height of COVID on getting products from one side of the world to your place. So you want to get them closer together. But again, it's as you know, it's the ongoing issue, the ongoing saga of the sanctions and preventing increasing ties and getting those figures back up to what they were back in 2019 of $17 billion plus.
Mr. Cochran, apart from oil trade, the two countries have conducted business in non-oil products as well. And now, don't you think more areas beyond energy and petrochemicals could be explored?
There's a lot of areas where there could be a lot more cooperation and more business and trade. After oil, it's primarily fertilizers that India wants from Iran, but also fruits and vegetables and vice versa. And Iran wants Indian rice and needs it and wants more of that as well as tea. These are big business ties. There's lots of money going involved with this. But the problem is, though, in many senses, that there's not a huge amount yet that either side can sort of offer each other in terms of services or technology. But there are definitely areas which there could be more cooperation or more sales. The car market, for instance, is a potential one. Both India and Iran have their own car industries. They have sizable industries, and they could increase sales to each other on those fronts. But it's technology.